You're listening to the Broadway Belters podcast, where we sit down with some of Broadway's brightest stars to learn more about their journey behind the scenes. Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Broadway Belters podcast. I am your host, Nick Ferreo, and I am just beside myself right now because one of my absolute favorite human beings in this industry is our guest today. Please join me in welcoming the Tony Award nominated Jen Colella.
Hi, my love. Thank you for that sweet introduction.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Of course.
I would love to go all the way back to the beginning here and just, can you tell us about where you grew up and how you discovered theater as a kid?
Totally. I'm happy to. I first want to say how excited I was when I saw that I was on Broadway Belters when I was featured. I was like, yes. Oh, it makes me so, so happy. So thank you.
Oh my gosh.
For the honor. I love it.
Oh, please.
So I grew up in South Carolina, in a town called Somerville, South Carolina, just outside of Charleston, where there was not a lot of theater. So I just sang in choirs. I was in like a school choir, later in like high school, concert choir, show choir. I was just like choir, choir, choir all the time so that I could continue to sing around people and to make that vibration that felt the most important to me. And then it wasn't until I did my undergraduate work at Columbia College in South Carolina, and that was beautiful and fantastic. Again, more choir. And then right after, I was in a rock band, and that is kind of where I developed my belt. I learned to sing through like whiskey, you know, so I had the choir. So I was like, I was a first soprano, right? And so I was able to sing really high, but then I was like, how do I get rock and roll into my bones, because it's always in my bones, but how do I mix all of these influences that I love, like Aretha Franklin and Otis Redding and Barbara Streisand and, you know, all of these people, like, what do I do to make the sound that I want to make? And for me, like, being in a rock band and combining that with my choir background is kind of like how I think how I got my sound.
That's awesome. That's fascinating. So when did you know, there wasn't a lot of theater in South Carolina. What was it that first piqued your interest about that whole musical theater world? When did you find out about it?
My stepmom took me to see Phantom of the Opera. And that was my first big show that I had ever seen. And so it's that thing that everybody says, right? Like, I was in the balcony, I was leaning over, she kept having to pull me back for fear that I'd fall over the balcony. And I felt that thing, Nick, where I was like, oh, I can do this. I'm supposed to do this. I'm supposed to be there. I could just imagine myself there in a way that felt like home that nothing else had. So that was Phantom of the Opera was the first show that I saw. And I was like, 100% I'm doing this.
I'm sold. you were out in LA for a while before you came to New York. What brought you out to LA? You were kind of, I knew you were doing the comedy thing. Tell us about, you know, how you found your way out there.
Totally. So while I was in the rock band, I became a company member for one of the only professional theaters at the time, Trust Us Theater. And that's really where my education began. Such extraordinary artists. It's still there today in Columbia, South Carolina. They do shows that other theaters, especially in the South, would not touch, right? We were doing Nikki Silver. We were doing Angels in America. They had a late night series where we did a show called Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, right? It was like all
Love
of these.
That.
Yeah, yeah. So I just immersed myself in with this group of people and learned so much. So the combination of doing that and being in the rock band for about 3 years out of undergrad, and then I was accepted as a Chancellor's Fellow to the University of California at Irvine for my master's degree.
Okay.
So that's what brought me out west, was that graduate program. And that was also life-changing. Just an incredible program. Not one of these like conservatories that molds you into a certain type of actor, right? But rather, they gave us a ton of tools and they were like, take what you want and become the kind of actor that you want to be. So like Beth Malone also was there while I was there, Andrew Simonsky, and a lot of incredible people were there. It was one of the best moves I've ever made for my life and my career. And then from there, I started doing stand-up in Los Angeles and in Hollywood. I was a regular at the Laugh Factory and the Comedy Store.
That's awesome. What kind of stand-up were you doing? What material were you throwing out there?
It was very much observational humor. Like, I grew up listening to Richard Pryor and Paula Poundstone and Ellen DeGeneres, right? So it was very much observational humor. I was like starting to inch my way out of the closet a little bit, but yeah, I was just kind of cutting my teeth. The most beautiful thing about stand-up for me was that I could fail miserably and not have anyone else to blame it on. It's my material, it's my delivery. But then I would learn that if I bombed in one moment, I could get the audience back in the next, right? I could, in the next breath, the next joke, get them back. And it really offered me some valuable wisdom on courage and trusting that should it all seem like it's crashing down, the world keeps spinning. There's nothing that can happen on stage that's so awful that you can't get it back. And I find that truly helpful even to this day.
Yeah, for sure. So you're doing well for yourself out in LA. You kind of found your groove in that stand-up comedy world. Were you content being in LA, or did you still have this desire that I want to take a crack at New York? I want to get into that theater world.
It's so interesting, right? Because, and I'm finding this now, I teach a lot of college students and they are torn about where do I go? And I had the same dilemma. Do I go to New York? Do I go to LA? And it doesn't matter. Both towns will always be there. You can go wherever you want and see how it feels and then go elsewhere. And I just didn't realize that was an option, right? So I was digging LA. It wasn't until I got a callback for Urban Cowboy, the musical, that I was kind of brought back to New York. I didn't expect that that was going to be an audition that changed my life, but it certainly was. Mm-hmm. And so once I became, all of a sudden I was the lead of a Broadway show, I didn't know that that could happen so quickly. And so once I got a taste for rehearsing and living in New York and what that was, I was kind of bi-coastal for a little while, but I fell madly, madly in love with New York and the community there.
Let's talk Broadway debut for a moment then. You came to New York and made that Broadway debut in 2003 playing Sissy in Urban Cowboy. Mm-hmm. What was your audition process like for that show? You said you were kind of flying back and forth a little bit, right? How did that play out?
So actually, part of our, we had a showcase for grad school, and it was a showcase with NYU and Yale at the time. And so it's for various casting directors in both New York and LA. And the one in New York, Jay Bender Casting, saw me, Jack Bowden specifically, was with Jay Bender at the time. And they called me in for Urban Cowboy, the musical. And I had grown up, I loved that movie. I'm from the South. Yeah. So I was like, absolutely, this feels right. They wanted a country song, and I didn't have a country song. I had that beautiful song from Closer Than Ever, The Man Says Things He Needs to Say, and I just turned it into a country song. I was like, man says things he needs to say, right? And then they were like, great, we love it. Can you sing it higher? I was like, totally. The man says things, like, not a problem. And so I was thrilled because this was my first big audition. It was while I was there for a grad school showcase. They called me back again and again. And then they were like, we're going to go with the girl with whom we've done the workshop for these many years. Months and months later, I got this call from my agent. Months and months after I had settled in LA. And she said, hey, do you remember that Urban Cowboy audition? And I said, yeah, I didn't get that. Thanks for bringing that up. And she goes, no, something has happened. The cast has been in rehearsal for a couple of weeks. And the director, Phil Osterman, has suddenly passed away of a heart attack, and they've brought in a new director, Lonnie Price, and he has a completely different version for what the female lead should be. The producers told him about your audition months ago, and they want to fly you to New York tomorrow. And if you get it, you start the next day.
Oh my gosh.
Right. So I was like, how you pack for that trip, right? So they faxed me the sides. They flew me first class. I'd never flown first class. I'm like learning these songs on the plane. And I arrive and I do the audition, and I remember sweet Lonnie Price's face looking at me with such love in his eyes. And I finished my audition. And as I was walking out of the room, Nick, I thought, oh my gosh, my whole life could change in this instant. And like, no sooner had that thought crossed my heart, they called me back in and he was like, welcome to Broadway. We want you to be our leading lady. And I burst into tears, and Jack Bowden from Jay Bender's office was like, I found her. And everybody was like clapping, and I'm weeping, and I'm like, thank you so much. And the stage manager was like, are you Equity? And I said, no, dude. And he goes, you will be tomorrow morning. Oh, and so crap. It was like this all of a sudden, I'm the lead of a Broadway show and introduced to a cast that has already been, you know, they've formed this bond and this love for the woman who was the lead, who was Caroline McMahon, an incredible actress. The very next show I did was a new work called Heartland, directed by Susan Shulman, written by Kim Sherman. And Caroline and I played sisters in that musical and became dear friends. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, look at that. Look
Isn't
at that.
That such a cool thing? The universe gave us the opportunity. Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's just one of my favorite things in the world to be connected to her. And she's a beautiful human being.
That's incredible. So Urban Cowboy was unfortunately short-lived, only running 60 performances over at the Broadhurst Theater. But what did you take away besides having this life-changing overnight Broadway debut story, which is just wild? What did you take away from that experience looking back on it?
Well, first of all, I didn't know that shows could open and close so quickly. I signed a year contract, so I was very surprised that would happen. But what didn't I take away? I found within me the courage and the knowledge to know that I could lead a Broadway show. You know, I had always hoped that I could, and I knew I wanted to, but then to be like, all right, here you go, champ, and put you in the ring, and for me to put on my big girl boots and to do it, and to feel like I led that company with love and compassion, and that we all took such good care of one another, even in the face of not being a hit, felt like a true success for me. It also introduced me to Lonnie Price, who has been one of my dear friends and champions for the entire time I've been in New York. Jason Robert Brown was our musical director. He wrote a song for me during that piece, We Fell Madly in Love. Tom Kitt was the associate MD.
Yeah.
I fell madly in love with him. I have so many dear friendships. It was a lot of our first, like Tyler Haynes, Matt Cavanaugh. It was a lot of our Broadway debuts. So we all fell madly in love, and some of those friendships have been Now these are like family members to me. So that was the biggest thing that I took away for those relationships, for sure.
Besides learning that a Broadway show could open and close so quickly, do you remember what was also surprising to you about Broadway in that first experience?
That's such an interesting question. I think what was most surprising, Nick, was how very much like any other staged production it was. I'm just as proud of work that I did in a black box theater in Irvine, California, as I was on the Broadhurst stage, right? Like, it's the same. Once you get past all the glitz and the glam and the press and the hoo-ha and all that other stuff, it's still just you connecting with an audience and with those cast members and trying to make this the most authentic character possible. So it was the sameness of it that felt pretty extraordinary to me.
It was during this time that you also got your infamous star tattoo on your arm, correct?
That's right. That is correct.
Can you tell us that story behind that a little bit?
Well, I've already intimated that my first love of the musical theater world was Phantom of the Opera. So my sweet little 18-year-old self got the Phantom of the Opera mask to, you know, just kind of commemorate my love and my desire and my dedication to the craft. So then I'm at the Broadhurst, which is the theater next to the Phantom of the Opera. And I thought, I can't really open as the lead of this show with a Phantom tattoo. So I went with another cast member, Chad Skiro, and we both got stars. He's got like a beautiful phoenix rising from the ashes holding a star. And I knew that I wanted a star because it was my first starring role, but also what stars represent, guidance and light. And it's kind of a unifying symbol to remind me that we're all connected. So the Phantom's under there.
He's under there somewhere.
He's under there.
A few years later came High Fidelity. The show opened on Broadway at the Imperial Theater on December 7th of 2006 and closed on December 17th of 2006 after about 18 performances, I think it was. What is it like to be on the inside of that experience when you work so hard? It's not just in the theater, it's a full-time commitment. So what is it like then when you're not received well? How do you move past that?
It was crushing, and it wasn't crushing just on a personal level. It was so hard to see my dear friends like Tom Kitt and Amanda Green and the artistic, the creative team. All of us obviously put our hearts into it, but this is their baby, right? And to have it not just not received, but like pulverized was totally crushing and disheartening. And there's nothing you can do except for be there in it together and love one another through it and move through it with as much grace and love as possible. And, you know, nothing is guaranteed in this business. business. Whenever we start out, there's nobody, no mentor or teacher or parent who's like, this is the easiest path you can choose. Go on. Like everybody, this is heartbreaking and it's soul crushing. It'll find different ways to break your heart. And so it's actually a wonderful reminder that nothing is guaranteed. We were lucky to have those 2 weeks on a Broadway stage. We are so lucky to have that cast album because deeply, deeply proud of that cast album. Mm-hmm. And the experience itself, regardless of how short-lived it was, I'm honored that I got to do it at all. And that's the truth of it. We're never guaranteed a long run in any way. So that's why it really helped me enjoy every costume fitting, anything out of the sits probe. I'll cry, I'll weep every sits probe. Like every rehearsal, I just really try to be as deep in my gratitude as possible because you never know how long it'll last.
Mm-hmm. We have to talk about Chaplin a bit. I just loved that show mm-hmm. so much. It was beautiful. And it brought you back to Broadway in 2012. You got to work with Warren Carlyle as director mm-hmm. choreographer. He did some beautiful things with that production. And Mr. Rob McClure as Chaplin himself.
Come on with Rob McClure. Can you stand him? Can you even take what an extraordinary person and talent he is?
Tell us about some of your favorite memories from that production, that process. What do you think about?
I think about Rob and I think about he and Warren just celebrating every new little bit that they could create. I mean, Rob is the hardest worker I've ever seen in my life, and he does it with such joy, such celebration. He is the epitome of what a leader should be: prepared, excellent attitude, celebration. If it's hard, he stays in it and works even harder. I've just learned so much being around him. And again, another cast, I don't mean to sound hippy trippy, but we all fell madly in love with each other. And one of my favorite memories is being in Rob McClure's dressing room and all of us getting tattoos by a woman named Friday Jones. A lot of us got the hat and mustache, this cute little
Wow.
just to commemorate the experience and how special it was. So that's definitely up there.
That's awesome. And that another iconic Jen Colella song, All Falls Down, which the ladies of musical theater are really latching onto these days. They're singing it everywhere.
Such an honor. It's my favorite thing to hear.
It's a good old song. Then came If Then, which starred Idina Menzel in her big return to Broadway in 2014. You played Anne in the show, who was one of the fabulous lesbians with your girlfriend, LaShawn's.
Yes.
Who we all love so much. And you also were the understudy for Idina Menzel. We had the standby, Jackie Burns. After Jackie Burns, you were next in line to go on for Elizabeth, and you did end up going on one time, correct?
Yes, can you believe it?
You want to tell us about that day?
I've never covered anyone ever. They asked if I would, and again, I was just like, oh, yes, I've never done this, but absolutely. So first of all, it was cool. Understudy rehearsals were awesome and an exciting way to just get to know people more and the show in a more intimate way. But I never dreamed, Nick, that I would go on. Jackie Burns, first of all, Idina was so solid. She very rarely missed. Jackie Burns is such a badass and was just extraordinary and always there. This was a one-time thing. Jackie was out of town. Idina, was not feeling her best for a matinee. And I was terrified, to be quite honest. It's just such big shoes to fill, both of them, quite honestly. And there's that moment at the beginning of If Then, the whole show starts with this beautiful star moment. Idina is standing up on this bridge and there's a spotlight and she goes, hey, it's me. And like the crowd goes wild, and for it to not be her and then not Jackie Burns, who people also love, but then Colella, I was terrified of that moment. I thought it was going to be like crickets or booze or what the hells, but they were very warm, very sweet. I had a lot of friends show up. I think I tweeted maybe a couple of hours prior to showtime that I was going on, and a lot of folks from Broadway.com like left their offices to come. Some folks from I found that I was deeply what I knew, but it was just kind of solidified that I felt really, really supported by my community that day. And my cast was so kind to me and I got through it. I can remember LaShawn's right after, I had that kind of wild-eyed, we've just finished the show, taking a big breath. And LaShawn's came up to me and she embraced me and she goes, was that fun? You ready to do it again? I was like, I do not want to do that again. No, ma'am. That's great. I'm glad I got to do it. Cool to be in Adina's dressing room for
check.
Check. Yeah. Why don't we go ahead and bring Idina back on?
Oh, man.
Let her do her thing.
It Then was also your longest Broadway running show at that point. You guys had a nice year-long run. What did it feel like to finally be able to kind of get a little bit comfortable and you know, the show had a solid year? What did that feel like?
That was delicious. That was incredible. The cast actually threw me a party after the, I think it was like 4 or 4.5 month mark that we've been open, because then it was officially my longest Broadway run. It's delicious. Then it feels like, you know, now we get to continue to keep it fresh and create it and deepen our love for each other and find new ways to keep the show alive while still keeping the thing that Michael Greif, you know, wanted us to do. Michael Greif is so extraordinary. He's our director. Mm-hmm. He was there through the entire run. I mean, he was there most nights. He really still so involved. And very often it's so sad because the creative team after opening night, they're gone. And we're like, where did mom and dad go? We've been doing this for them for so long. But Michael was very present. And I just love that about him. He really still cares about a show even after it's opened and cared very much about us. And we got notes. And I just love that about him. I just think that's extraordinary that he really wanted to keep it going himself. And David Alpert was an extraordinary assistant director, and they just both were dedicated to keeping the thing what it was meant to be. And it was beautiful. And getting
that's amazing.
With Dee and LaShans and James Snyder and all those incredible people.
Oh, yeah. That cast was just stacked.
Tamika Lawrence, get out.
Tamika Lawrence, one of my favorite voices in the biz.
One of my favorite people in the world.
Yeah, that was a good group. That was a good group of people. Mm-hmm. And then came the big Broadway hit for Jen Colella, Come From Away. For those who don't know, the show is set in the week following the September 11th attacks and tells the true story of what transpired when 38 planes were ordered to land unexpectedly in Gander, a very small town up in Canada. When did you first get involved with this show? Were you part of those early workshops, or did you come along a little bit later in the process?
I wasn't part of the initial workshops, no, but I was called to audition while I was in If Then, actually. It was towards the end of our run. And I remember getting the script and thinking, that's pretty cool. But they want me to play this older pilot lady. And in the song, I sang this song called Me in the Sky.
Yeah.
And in that tune, I sing Somehow I'm 51. And I was like, not a chance. Like, oh, how sweet. But no way. No way. So I went in, Nick, thinking, okay, let me go and audition for Telsey and for Chris Ashley. And I love working at La Jolla, my favorite regional theater to work at anywhere in the world.
Beautiful.
So I was like, I'll go in and remind them how I prepare and who I am and what I do, even if I don't have a chance at this at all. And then I got a call back and I was like, oh, that's nice of them. That's sweet. Or perhaps they want to, you know, kind of use me to see who it is they're really looking at and kind of bounce us off one of them. Happy to help them out. And then there's a moment, sometimes this beautiful moment in an audition when you can feel them just wanting it to be you and accepting you and loving everything you're doing. And I can remember that moment. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get this. I'm going to play this captain lady. Turns out the 51 is not a problem. And that was totally fine. Then I was just so thrilled to, again, like anytime creators honor me with this new piece that no one else has done in a full production, and they're like, here's our baby and we're trusting you with it. I could cry right now. It's like it's the most extraordinary thing for someone to trust me with that. And so originating that role is one of the greatest joys and honors of my life, for sure.
So the show goes to, like you said, La Jolla Playhouse, then you did Seattle, Washington, D.C. Then you guys did this concert version of Come From Away in Gander in this like hockey arena for a few thousand people. What was that experience like for you? Talk about a unique pre-Broadway pit stop.
It was dope, man. I'll never forget it as long as I live. First of all, we learned we're not overdoing it. Like, those people are that nice. I remember a friend of mine and I were trying to get to the liquor store and three different cars stopped. I'm like, where are you going? How can we help you? Where are you heading?
Oh,
and we're
gosh.
Like, oh, no, just, and finally we got into this strange man's car after like the third one. We're like, totally, dude, you can take us the 2 seconds up the road to the liquor store.
Wow.
Did.
Wow.
But performing for those people in that hockey rink and feeling the energy. In the opening number, there's a lyric where we sing, I'm an Islander. Mm-hmm. The first time we sang, I'm an Islander, the entire crowd rose to their feet and started stomping and clapping. And we all just lost.
Ooh, it's got chills.
We just started weeping. I will never forget it. I did too. I thought about it then for every other, you know, I did the show almost 1,200 times after that, I always thought of them rising to their feet and this sense of pride of being this Newfoundlander and what we were bringing and them showing us that they were grateful. I'll never forget it as long as I live.
Ugh, man. Like you said, you played Captain Beverly Bass in Come From Away, the first female captain of an American Airlines commercial plane. Mm-hmm. She is very much a real life person who is still alive and became a presence in that theater, enjoyed mm-hmm. getting involved with the show. Was that intimidating at first? And how did your relationship with Beverly evolve over time and grow?
It was a little intimidating at first, but not for long. I gotta be honest, she took such good care of me and my heart and was so genuinely supportive that I never felt like, oh gosh, I wanted to honor her, and that has never gone away. But I didn't feel like I'm gonna get it wrong because she was always so generous with her compliments about what I was doing and how I was creating it. And I remember the first time meeting her. It was our last preview at La Jolla. She and her husband, Tom, had just flown in. They had no idea, Nick, what the show was about. They had been interviewed in Gander by this young couple, and then they were invited to this opening night in California, but they had no clue that she had such a big role in this musical. They didn't know what to expect. I actually see her in a restaurant called James's Place, which is right across the street from the theater in La Jolla where we would go after each show. And I walked in and she and I kind of locked eyes immediately across the room. She made her way over to me and she said, "I think you're playing me." And I said, "I think you're right." And we immediately embraced and felt this like kinship, just sweetness. And then she launches into her experience about how it felt to be this pilot and how she was like, "Look, there were 38 planes on that tarmac." And I was like, "You don't say." And she was like, we waited for like 28 hours. And I was like, you don't say. And then Tom, her husband, jumped in and he was like, "We have this map in the kitchen. We put these pins in places that we've flown." And that's a direct lyric in a song that I sang. And I thought in my head, you two are going to lose your minds tomorrow night when you see this thing. And sure enough, there she was, third row, right in front of me. I started singing the song, and I can remember just watching her head drop into her hands and her shoulders started shaking, and she was completely overcome with emotion. And I don't know how I went on. I think just my sheer will to honor the piece and to honor her. And then, of course, she saw it hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And had kind of the same reaction each time. She was just as jazzed every time she saw the show. So I was very, very lucky to have someone so loving and so supportive in my corner throughout that whole experience.
That's incredible. Your portrayal of Beverly earned you your very first Tony Award nomination. What did that nomination mean to you?
Oh my goodness. It meant a lot to me, obviously, as a little kid, like in the mirror with my hairbrush, you know what I mean? Like singing in the mirror. This has been a dream of mine, right? Like that is a goal. And what I learned is that it wasn't just about, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm being honored for my work. It felt like I was being honored for all of the things that I had done leading up to it. It didn't feel like it was just for Captain Bass. The community was so sweet in letting me know, "It's time, Colella, we're proud of you." Mm-hmm. It was like my community saying, "We believe in what you've been doing all these years." And so that felt like the truest, most incredible honor. And then I learned about myself that while I was stoked to be nominated and it would certainly be fun to win, that I wasn't like, "I have to win this thing." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A part of it. I was able to enjoy the press and the parties and the, you know, some people are like, "Oh my God, it's exhausting. I had to do Jimmy Kimmel and then this and this, and I had to do the show." And I was like, you will never find me complaining about this 6 weeks leading up to the Tony Awards because it's everything I've ever wanted. And I get to be surrounded by all of these people whom I deeply respect and admire. I got to be dear friends with all of the women in my category. Stephanie Block insisted that we all meet together for a meal soon after the announcement came out for the nominations. So me and, you know, Kate and Stephanie and Mary Beth Peel and Rachel got to hang out and we did it a lot. So I was dear friends with these women whom I was supposed to be in competition with. And I learned I don't believe in the competition part. We're completely different artists. All the things we were doing were completely different. It could have gone to any one of us and it would have been just fine. And that was fun to kind of discover along the way.
What's it like to be at Tony Awards that night when you're a nominee and you, like you said, you're feeling that the community is celebrating you? Imagine the energy in that room is unforgettable.
You're correct. Well, first of all, that press line is unlike anything else. That felt like, I don't know, my mom was with me. So that felt super special because she was just beaming. You know, Anna Wintour dressed me. So I felt fantastic. My mom was there. It was really the thing with photographers where they're like, Jen, over here, Jen, look over here, Jen, here. And I was like, no way. I was just laughing. I was like, all the pictures, I'm kind of open mouth, like, because it was too much. It was just amazing. And then the interviews along the way leading into it, my heart felt like it was going to explode because my whole life I'd wanted to be in this moment and I felt present and I felt ready and I felt like I didn't care who won or lost. And so it was just this immense sense of belonging and pride. And then being in that room and we were at the opening number with the Rockettes, like to be arm in arm with Rockettes and my cast members and just celebrating being in Radio City, looking out over that crowd, a Radio City Music Hall, like Sarah Paulson. I saw her. I saw like all these people. It was heaven. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I'm so proud that I felt present the entire night and didn't just let it kind of wash over me or worry about, oh gosh, what's going to happen or what if I mess up or what if I don't. I just wanted to experience every moment for what it was. And I think I succeeded.
That's beautiful because you hear so many stories of people saying, oh my gosh, it was a blur. I blacked out. And it's just incredible that you were able to stay so present and soak
Thanks,
in that.
Man.
Come From Away fans bring dedication to a whole other level. That show has built quite the loyal following. Can you share with us some unforgettable or special stage door encounters, encounters?
Oh my gosh, I gotta tell you, these people are so sweet. And because it's a show about kindness, Nick, these fans are, the reason they're fans is because these are people who also believe in kindness and the practice of kindness. So they are taking care of us. They wanna share their stories. I don't know if I could just give you one. Every single fan looks deep into our eyes. It's not about, oh my gosh, I love those notes you're hitting. It's because they're moved by the story. So again, it feels even better than like somebody being like, wow, you're a powerhouse, but rather like, thanks for telling the story you're telling. As an artist, for me, it feels even better. And that they're fans who have become friends because of the show. There are people who've become lovers and partners because of the show. That for me is what feels the best, is that it's a community of kindness. And that's what people want to share when they're at the stage door. And so it just feels like I get to hug a bunch of people at the end of my workday. And it's tremendous. I cannot believe my luck with these fans. And now because of this time, because of like Cameo and Broadway Plus and Broadway Booker, I'm now able to connect with fans in a way that I wasn't. I didn't have the time. We didn't have these platforms. So now I'm getting to have like one-on-ones or videos for fans that I wouldn't normally have done. So that is a bonus for me during this
time.
That's
awesome. It's like a blessing in disguise, right?
It's awesome. It's dope.
That's awesome. Speaking of, you know, sharing your story, I had kind of put off seeing Come From Away for some reason. I don't know. I was like, oh, I'll get to it.
Totally.
And then one day I was having like, you know, it was a weird week at work and there was a snowstorm happening. So I'm like, oh, I feel like I just need to go see a show and the tickets will probably be really cheap on like StubHub or something. So I scored a $40 front row center ticket to see Come From Away. And I don't remember the last time up until that day that I had been able to get lost in the theater, fully taken away and just so moved. And I feel like it's one of the shows that people find their way to it when they need it the most. So I hope that when Broadway returns, people who might have been putting it off, they'll find their way to it when they really need it.
I love that, Nick. I've never heard it put that way, but I think you're exactly right. People come to Come From Away when they are called to, when their heart is like, I need something that is absolutely pure, because it is. It is a true story about others taking care of people in need. And mm-hmm. I love that notion that people are going to find themselves drawn back to that show. And I believe it wholeheartedly. That mm-hmm. show is not ever going to go out of style because it's a message that we will constantly need to be reminded of.
Especially right now, just in this time where, you know, I think I'm guilty of it sometimes, getting caught up in that, only hearing the negativity and mm-hmm. kind of forgetting about, we all are inherently good.
Yes.
And I was reminded that when I think I needed it most. So I'm always thankful to Come From Away for that moment.
I love that.
Can you share what it's like to do a performance of Come From Away on 9/11? I imagine that brings a whole other energy to the space.
Indeed, yes, very powerful. There's a reverence that's always the foundation of the show, but on that day, we would normally have first responders or people who were plain people on that day come. And so there's just this sense of responsibility and honor and ultra focus so that we can tell the story. It feels a little harder that day to not get wrapped up in our own emotions. And Chris Ashley was super smart and made sure that he kept the show non-emotional on our part so that we could let the audience feel however they wanted to feel. Because it's super easy. We could just cry and wallow and the whole, but he really was like, Don't let that be the case. Your job is to tell this story. And so on 9/11, that felt more challenging to do, quite honestly, because I just wanted to sob through the whole thing. But we had a sense of dedication to the piece and to presenting it the way that it was intended. And I think the focus was a little sharper on those days for certain.
One of the many things I love about you is how open and unapologetically proud you are to be your true, authentic self. But like most people, that is a process. You've said before that when you first came to New York, you were encouraged or advised by people who you respected to not come out in your career. When did you finally decide that wasn't going to work for you anymore?
It was when I was cast as Bebo Brinker in the Bebo Brinker Chronicles, which is this beautiful Anne Bannon, these Anne Bannon novels that were made into the off-Broadway show directed by Lee Silverman. And I was, you know, playing the lead character, and she's quite butch and most definitely gay. And it just felt wrong. I was like, if I'm going to be authentic to myself, and in these interviews and all these beautiful queer people are coming to see this, and then thinking about my own upbringing in South Carolina and how rare it was to see any kind of queer representation, it just kind of came crashing down on me, Nick. I was like, I have a responsibility to myself and to any one queer person who might be in the audience who needs to see somebody who is out on the stage. And so I just decided in my next interview that I was going to come out, and it was so much easier than I thought it was going to be. Not only did nobody care, they, in a negative way, they were like, thank you. Thanks for being honest. Thanks for coming out. And then that has been such a cool part of this whole journey that I didn't expect. I didn't know that being openly gay was going to be a part of my career and that would be something that people would look up to. But I'm really, really grateful that it is. And I take that responsibility very seriously.
This Broadway shutdown that we're in right now has obviously been devastating for the livelihoods of so many people in this community, but it has also given us a bit of an opportunity to take a step back and think about and discuss the desperate need for some systematic change and racial equity within our own industry. Mm-hmm. What changes do you hope to see when Broadway returns?
Oh, so excited about this. So revivals are fine, and I think they're fine, but I don't think we need as many of them. And that old story of like, oh, this poor woman is getting beat by one guy and she just needs this other guy to be all that old stuff. We've seen it. We're not that anymore. We need new voices. We need diversity. We need color. We need exactly what is going on in the world. And that's not always pretty and lovely, but we need to see it. So I am thrilled that we're going to see new artists emerge. We're going to hear new voices and we're going to get some new stories. I want queer stories. I want trans stories. I want people of color. I want all of these things to come to the forefront the way that they have needed to so that we can get the diversity that we desire, so it can be truly representative of the human race and what's going on, and not just this one heteronormative thing that has been flooding our senses. And thank you. I'm grateful for the classics. I'm grateful for everything that's come before, but it is time for change and I am hungry for it. I'm thrilled about it.
Not agree more.
Right
now,
on.
If you're willing, we have a few fan questions that were submitted.
Of course.
So many people were eager to ask you a question. This is from mhawk2 on Instagram. Was there a moment in your career where you realized I'm living the dream right now?
Oh gosh, what a great question. It happens to me all the time. It happens to me many, many times. I think the first time was probably Urban Cowboy. There was a night we were supposed to close and Lonnie Price came out on stage and started thanking everyone in the entire theater, like from the spot ops to, you know, Jason Robert Brown. And then we're all crying. We think it's our last night. And then he goes, and I've just been informed by our producers that we will not be closing tonight. We're going to stay open. And the entire entire Broadhurst Theater erupted. Gypsy was next door. Bernadette Peters Gypsy was next door. And they said they could hear the eruption. It was like we won the World Series. And in that moment, I thought, oh my gosh, what is my life? This is extraordinary. I can't believe this is happening. That might have been the first one.
That's amazing. At underscore nerd Faith Wong would like to know, how are you enjoying living in Canada? I'm a Canadian, so Jen being here makes me so happy.
I love it. You know, obviously Canada has had a special place in my heart for the past 5 years. I've come from away. I have fallen in love with a Canadian. It's just been an incredible place to shelter. The people are extraordinary. This place is extraordinary. I cannot believe my luck. I'm really, really grateful to be here. There's a lot of snow around. I'm getting ready for what this winter is going to hold. I'm trying to brave my little South Carolinian heart for that. but I could not be more grateful. Canadians are extraordinary people. And it feels more like home than just a place to visit now.
Speaking of falling in love with a Canadian, your lovely partner, Shalina Kennedy, who we also love, Broadway star, at SW007 would like to know, what show would you like to do with Shalina?
Oh, great question. So many. But she is currently writing this extraordinary musical called Call It Love. And she has written a role in it for me, and so I'm hoping that she will play the lead, although she's not sure if she should because it's her own show. We've done a couple of labs where we've played off of one another, and my ultimate dream is to have a full production of this new incredible musical with her playing the lead and me playing one of her love interests. That is the goal.
At Rebecca Morowitz would like to know how you two met.
Oh, it was very sweet, actually. Shalina was currently starring as Carole King in Beautiful at the time. And we had a mutual friend, Sue Dunstan, who was one of our swings in the Broadway cast in Come From Away. And she convinced Shalina to come and see the show. And I think I had been on her radar. She'd like walked by the theater to kind of check me out, saw me talking to somebody outside the theater and like liked the way I was talking to them. So it is all unbeknownst to me, this little plan they were hatching. And she comes to see the show. We all, like a big group of us, go to Glass House Tavern after. And it wasn't until the end of the night, we struck up this beautiful conversation about motherhood. And I was thanking her for raising this kid, and what a responsibility it must feel to have a white male to raise, and thanking her because we need, you know, gentle, loving, aware, woke white males, and what a responsibility, and thanking her for doing it. And she was like, we should hang out sometime. And I was like, oh, totally. Yeah, let's exchange numbers. And she goes, no, can I take you out sometime? And I was like, oh, okay. So from that moment on, I was just like completely smitten. I didn't realize that this whole plan had been hatching for us to get together. So it's just been delightful. She's an extraordinary person, and I'm super, super, I'm grateful to know her at all. Certainly I've had the chance to love her.
We will end it by asking, if you could go back now and talk to little Jen Colella back in South Carolina, who was dreaming of a life in some sort of performing arts, what would you tell her?
I love this question because I know the answer. It's so ready now, and it wasn't then. I didn't know what I needed to know. And what I needed to know, Nick, I would tell this little girl, you are enough. That you don't have to be like anyone else. You can have people whom you respect and admire, but you don't have to emulate any other artists. Trust that you are enough wherever you are, at whatever stage of your life that you are. And hearing that would have helped me, I think, keep the voice in my head and heart much, much softer. So to any young artist who might be listening to this incredible podcast, please trust that you're enough wherever you are in your world right now. And that's going to help you out tremendously, I promise.
Absolutely. Jen, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with me.
It's been my pleasure.
You're just this bright light and epitome of kindness in our industry. We need more people like you. So thank you for that.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you. And thank you for honoring me and honoring all of the Beltresses for what we do and give. It feels so incredible. Truly, I appreciate you, brother.
I love it. Thank you so, so much.
Right on, man.
Hey, Broadway Belters listeners. If you enjoyed this episode, you can help us out by subscribing and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also follow us on Instagram at BUA Belters Podcast. And if you're feeling extra supportive, go ahead and share today's episode with a friend. The Broadway Belters Podcast was produced today by me, Nick Ferreo. Thank you for listening.